Welcome to the January 2016 edition of Annotated Bibliography Podcast, also known as Journal Scan or This Month in Other Journals besides the AJNR. I'm Jeff Ross, and for this edition, I've selected 8 articles from the recent literature that I found of some interest, and I hope that you will find them of interest as well. The references I'm discussing will be posted more explicitly onto the AJNR blog for your convenience. The first paper has the first author of Spetzler, and it is entitled The Barrow Ruptured Aneurysm Trial, 6-Year Results, and that's from the Journal of Neurosurgery in 2015. The authors report the results of this ongoing randomized trial with the final goal of a 10-year follow-up, comparing the safety and efficacy of surgical clip occlusion and endovascular coil embolization in patients presenting with subarachnoid hemorrhage from a ruptured aneurysm. 471 patients were randomly assigned to the treatments, 238 to surgical clipping and 233 to endovascular coiling. Whether to treat patients in the assigned group or to cross over to the other group was at the discretion of the treating physician. 38%, or 75 of 199 of the patients assigned to the coiling, were crossed over to clipping, and 1.9%, 4 out of 209, assigned to clipping, were crossed over to coiling. On the basis of a modified Rankin scale score of greater than 2, no significant difference in outcomes was detected between the two treatment groups. When aneurysm location was considered, the 6-year results showed no difference in outcome for anterior circulation aneurysms. Outcomes for posterior circulation aneurysms continued to favor coiling. With coiling, obliteration rates were significantly lower and retreatment rates significantly higher. Despite this, no recurrent hemorrhages were seen out to 6 years. Now, the second paper was from the same edition of Journal of Neurosurgery, and this is an editorial on the Spetzler paper, and the author is McDonald, and it's entitled Clip or Coil, 6-Year Follow-Up in BRAT, Barrow Ruptured Aneurysm Trial. So this editorial, as well as the author's response to the editorial from Drs. McDougall and Spetzler, is posted. The author of the editorial concludes that, quote, advocates of neurosurgical clipping of ruptured aneurysms are fighting an increasingly uphill battle with fewer and fewer troops, close quote. I do like the summary by Drs. McDougall and Spetzler at the end of their response to the editorial, and I'll just read it, quote, what can be seen in BRAT and in ISAT is that while subgroups of patients seem to benefit from coiling, there really are not many differences overall in outcomes between open surgery and aneurysm coiling. With clipping, an increased upfront surgical morbidity rate is offset by a decreased rate of delayed rehemorrhage. Whether this means that one should favor clipping or coiling is somewhat of a value judgment. If the overall difference is ultimately not great, then the implication is that within a given institution, relatively small differences in any one of the many elements of patient care, for example, practice pattern, judgment, and technical ability, could render irrelevant the results of even the most comprehensive trial, close quote. So let's go on to the third paper. This has an author of Gobrial, and it is entitled Surgical Management on 40 Consecutive Patients with Cervical Spinal Epidural Abscess. This is from Spine in 2015. So this is a retrospective review covering 1997 to 2011 that identified 40 consecutive patients with cervical spinal epidural abscess. The most common risk factor associated with spinal epidural abscess was intravenous drug abuse, which was found in 10 patients, or about 25%. The most common level of discitis involvement was C6-7 in 12 patients, or 30%. The most common neurologic grades at presentation were American Spinal Injury Association Impairment Scale, or AIS, level D in 20, that's 50%, which is a motor incomplete degree, followed by an AIS of E in 9, or 28%, which was normal. 65% of patients underwent anterior followed by posterior decompression and stabilization. So the authors note that there is a shift towards circumferential stabilization for cervical spondylodiscitis without the use of halo devices, and this did not result in an increase in reported periprocedural complications. So this is a nice case series that is just marred a little bit from my narrow perspective for not having any figures associated with it. Nonetheless, worth reading. Next is number 4. It has a first author of Graeudzi, and it is entitled Intrathecal Preservative-Free Normal Saline Challenge Magnetic Resonance Myelography for the Identification of Cerebrospinal Fluid Leaks in Spontaneous Intracranial Hypotension, again from the Journal of Neurosurgery in 2015. This is a retrospective review of 5 patients who underwent preservative-free normal saline challenge followed by intrathecal gadolinium contrast infusion and MR myelography from 2010 to 2012, 6 procedures total in the 5 patients. The concept is to use this technique to provoke and detect a CSF leak in patients with SIH. Preservative-free normal saline was instilled into the subarachnoid space at a rate of about 1 cc per minute to a total volume of approximately 1/3 of the total CSF fluid volume, which is sort of 50 cc's, although that is not explicitly stated. They were able to detect a CSF leak in 5 of 6 infusion procedures. In 4 cases, a leakage site had not been identified on previous CT myelography images from outside institutions, and in 1 case, they identified multiple additional leakage sites not detected with a previous CT myelogram. 3 patients, 60%, did experience immediate transient symptoms, which included feelings of anxiety, shortness of breath, pelvic pressure, headache, and numbness and tingling in both upper and lower extremities. So they caution that close neurologic monitoring is required. They conclude that preservative-free normal saline challenge combined with contrast-enhanced MR myelography is a relatively safe procedure and may aid in improved detection of CSF leaks in patients with SIH. So I guess the operative word is relatively safe. With only 5 patients, I think the N is really too small to know what's going on as far as safety, but it does seem like this is not a procedure for the faint of heart on both the patient and physician sides. On to number 5, and this has a first author of Jorgensen, and it is entitled Current Concepts in the Use of Stem Cells for the Treatment of Spinal Cord Injury, and this is from Seminars in Spine Surgery from 2015. I like this because it's short and concise review of the current status of stem cells for the treatment of spinal cord injury. It has 1 figure and 28 references. It also gives a nice summary of the history of the human trials that have occurred in this area and notes the current phase 1-2 cervical and thoracic spine trials using stem cell inks, WHO CNS SC stem cells. And I will post the website for that on the blog. So let's go on to number 6. This has a first author of Lee, and it is entitled Magnetic Resonance Imaging of Uveitis. This is from Neuroradiology in 2015. So uveitis is an inflammation of any part of the uveal tract, which is the vascular middle layer of the globe, made up of the choroid posteriorly and ciliary body and iris anteriorly. Uveitis is nonspecific and be caused by a variety of things, idiopathic, infectious, and non-infectious inflammatory systemic diseases. These non-infectious causes are things such as ankylosing spondylitis or ulcerative colitis, rheumatoid arthritis, sarcoid, Behçet's, relapsing polychondritis, and the ever-popular Voigt-Koinange-Harada disease, another systemic immune-mediated disease. The anatomical classification scheme divides the inflammation into 4 groups: anterior, which is the anterior chamber, intermediate, which is the posterior ciliary body, and posterior, which is retina and choroid, and then finally panuveitis. As with every other part of the body, the differential includes sarcoid and TB, particularly for the posterior and panuveitis types. So this case series highlights the MR and CT studies in 7 patients with uveitis and the clinical histories of 3 of them. Etiologies included ankylosing spondylitis, relapsing polychondritis, and VKH disease. Again, this is thought to result from autoimmune targeting of melanocytes and is characterized by bilateral granulomatous panuveitis. other cases that they had were sarcoidosis and tuberculosis. There are 7 figures and 33 references. On to number 7, has a first author of SNEED, and it is entitled Adverse Radiation Effects After Stereotactic Radiosurgery for Brain Metastases, Incidence, Time Course, and Risk Factors from Journal of Neurosurgery 2015. The authors use the term adverse radiation effect generically to include both reversible and irreversible radiation injury. The purpose of the study was to perform a rigorous in-depth analysis of the incidence, time course, and risk factors for both overall adverse radiation effect and symptomatic adverse radiation effect after stereotactic radiosurgery for brain mets. 435 patients with 2,200 metastases were evaluated, and the median patient survival time was 17 months or so, and median lesion imaging follow-up was 9.9 months. Among the 118 cases of adverse radiation effect, 60% were symptomatic and 85% occurred 3 to 18 months after stereotactic radiosurgery, with a median of about 7 months. Multivariate analysis, considering only mets with target volumes greater than 1 cubic centimeter, the risk factors for adverse radiation effect included prior stereotactic radiosurgery, a kidney primary tumor, connective tissue disorder, and systemic therapy with capecitabine. There are 7 tables and 6 figures with several Kaplan-Meier plots. Let's go on to number 8 then. This has a first author of George, and it is entitled Chordomas, a Review from Neurosurgical Clinics of North America in 2015. So I'm conflicted on the overall quality of this review article. On the one hand, I learned things about chordomas that I had not seen in print previously, or maybe I just missed, such as the role of the protein brachyury in making a specific diagnosis of chordoma that is linked to a specific gene locus, 6Q27, since this protein is expressed in any tissue that's derived from the notochord. This review also covers in some depth the various treatment modalities, including the potential use of tyrosine kinase receptor inhibitors and the use of proton beam therapy. On the other hand, the paper did not receive much in the way of copy editing, and there are multiple errors that made it difficult to read it, well, at least for me. One problem is the overaggressive use of abbreviations, my favorite being the abbreviation for the sacrum, which is S. So this leads to sentences that are really difficult for me to figure out, such as, quote, brachyury is always found in any tissue or lesion that is derived from the NC, including the CHs, the EPs, and BNCTs, as well as in the NC itself, close quote. Now, I know I live in a glass house, so I'm careful with that as far as copy editing, but this was kind of a couple standard deviations out there. There's also considerable problems with the figure legends, and one swapped figure legend in French, and the legends are in French on the graphs, which is otherwise completely in English. So to summarize, nuggets of information in this review, but approach it with caution. So there you have it, kind of a wide-ranging group of papers for this month. That's all for now. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. Again, if you have feedback on this podcast, email me with your criticism or praise at ajnr.eic@gmail.com. And thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.